This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
On climate change, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's positions seem to be moving very closely in lockstep with those of coal companies and some of the larger oil and gas companies.
What is the United States Chamber of Commerce? Many Americans hold a misconception that it's a government agency. It is not. It is the most significant lobbying group in the United States. And as our guests today on Sea Change Radio explain, it's a formidable foe of environmental protections and could easily be called an organized group for pollution advocacy. This week I talk with environmental ethicist Philip Cafaro, who explains the role that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce plays in promoting constant growth and how that premise inherently contradicts environmental sustainability. Next, Sean Goho, lawyer and lecturer at Harvard Law School, dissects the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's own statement on environmental issues and demonstrates how its current policies diverge drastically from the chamber's 19th century roots. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Philip Cafaro. He's a professor of philosophy at Colorado State University. He's also the VP of the International Society for Environmental Ethics. Phil, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here, Alex.
Phil, first tell us a little bit about your most recent article on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's your response to a white paper, correct?
That's right. Yeah, it's a report from the First Street Research Group, which is a Washington-based group which tracks lobbying in D.C. And they took a look at lobbying on two immigration bills, one of which was the Legal Workforce Act, H.R. 2885. And this was to make the use of the E-Verify employment verification system mandatory for all new hires around the country. So basically it was saying, if you're going to hire someone for a job, you need to do what you can to make sure they're in the country legally. And what the First Street Research Group found was that over $15 million was spent to defeat that bill, with only about $50,000 spent to support it. And the number one group working to defeat that bill was the Chamber of Commerce of the USA. The Chamber of Commerce spent over $10 million to defeat that bill.
It sounds like it's a federal agency, but this is far from it. Tell us a little bit more about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Phil.
Sure. The Chamber is a group set up to really represent business interests, both at the local and state levels and at the national level. So any of your listeners who are small business owners, many of them might well be members of their local Chamber of Commerce. And at the local level, the Chamber often does useful things. The problem is, at the national level, they've really evolved in recent decades into a very strong anti-environmental voice, an anti-worker voice. So if you're looking at a bill to reauthorize the Endangered Species Act, if you're looking at a bill to tighten up curbs on oil drilling, the Chamber is going to be in there fighting those kind of bills. Now, another thing that the Chamber does is they fight very hard for growth. And in particular, they work very hard to increase population growth in the United States. This is an aspect of their work that really hasn't gotten all that much attention, but we think it should.
And why would the U.S. Chamber of Commerce be interested in growing the U.S. population?
Well, for any one of a number of reasons, basically because it helps build a bigger economy. So the more people you bring into the country, the more consumers you have, the more people you bring into the country, the more potential workers you have. And of course, by flooding labor markets, you can drive down the cost of labor, and that's very much in the interests of big corporations.
And I would imagine their rejoinder would be, well, it's still better than sending jobs overseas where there are going to be even lower priced jobs or lower wage jobs. But what's the reality?
Well, you know, I mean, that would make sense if it was a choice between those two things. As a matter of fact, we're still sending lots of jobs overseas, and we're also importing a lot of workers to drive wages down. And a lot of these jobs are jobs that, for now and for the foreseeable future, would have to be done within this country. So, for instance, jobs waiting tables in restaurants, jobs making beds in hotels, jobs putting roofs on our houses, jobs in construction. These are all jobs that are difficult, if not impossible, to outsource. And so it really doesn't hold water to say we're doing this in order to keep from sending those jobs overseas.
Can you give us an idea of how powerful it is, this force?
Sure. For a start, the Chamber of Commerce is the largest lobbying group in the United States, the largest lobbying group in Washington, D.C. They spend the most money and have the largest number of lobbyists. And that's what sort of calls the tune in our nation's capital today. So it really starts from that. Then, of course, they are the most prominent spokespeople for the business community. And as a president once said, the business of America is business. So they have an incredibly, even before you throw the money into the pot, they have a tremendous opportunity to get people's ear and lobby for what they value. Now, it's unfortunate because you can certainly imagine a chamber of commerce and a business community that was more committed to the well-being of workers, that was more committed to sustainability. You can fantasize about a chamber of commerce which really did a lot to help put us on a more sustainable track. Because when you think about it, we're not going to get there without the business community. We're not going to get there without finding out a way to move past just pushing growth, and instead have a wider range of values that we're pursuing. And that can't just be academics talking about it or young people. It's got to be the businesses of America.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Phil Cafaro. He's a professor at Colorado State University. He's also the VP of the International Society for Environmental Ethics. Phil, what is the stated mission of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and what do you think is the real mission?
Well, I mean, I think the stated mission, I don't have the stated mission right in front of me, but I think they're relatively straightforward about what they value. They value economic growth. They value the growth of commerce and industry. And I think the problem is that growth, you know, the pursuit of growth served us well for a long time. Both environmentally and socially, I don't think it is anymore. And so what we've got, and by the way, you know, it's not just the Chamber of Commerce as if they're the bad guys. I think this is our society in general. Whether you're talking Republicans or Democrats, progressives or conservatives, the answer to all our problems is quite often seen as more growth.
And more jobs rather than better jobs.
More jobs rather than better jobs. You know, it's fascinating to me that when you talk, I am very involved in state and local politics here in Colorado. You can get all kinds of differences between Republicans and Democrats, but once they start talking about the economy, they tend to focus on the same thing. We need growth. We need more jobs. We need more economic activity. It's just the answer to everything. And the problem is it's hard to see how you can square that with both a sensible view of what we should be doing with our lives as human beings and also with a strong commitment to sustainability. Sustainability without limits to growth seems to me to be an impossibility.
Well, it sounds so divergent in some ways that you talk about the communities and that the chambers of commerce on local levels are actually fighting the good fight on a large part. But when you look at the governing body of all these smaller chambers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, that sense of community is completely askew from what, and they may not be similarly aligned in terms of values and may not be representing small businesses as well as the larger lobbying interests and business interest, muddied interests in the United States.
Well, I think that's right. And maybe it has something to do with just the scale. I mean, when you're working at the local level, you know, you can look your fellow chamber members in the eye, and you can talk to the executive director of the local chamber of commerce. And there's a sense in my town of Fort Collins, for instance, there's a sense that we're all in it together here, workers and small businessmen and some of the larger corporations that also have operations here. But when you move up to the national level, I think it's very easy to forget that we're all in it together. And it's much more easy to just pursue policies that are purely for the benefit of the few.
And now it's winter. Winter in America, and all of the healers done been killed. Sent away. Yeah, the people know it's winter. Winter in America.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Phil Cafaro. He's a professor at Colorado State University. He's also the VP of the International Society for Environmental Ethics. So what are some of the solutions that you see, Phil, to try to cut off a body like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce at the knees and to try to fight for what some of the local chambers might be fighting for?
Well, I think there are a number of things. Probably the most important thing we need to do in politics in our country today is work to lessen the influence of money. I think all the other things that you and I and your listeners might value, whether it's sustainability or anything else, it's going to be very hard to move in those directions when we're just outgunned. There's just almost no way that we can find a way to pool our money and fight the big corporations. So what we need is campaign finance reform, and probably what we need is an amendment to the Constitution denying the personhood of corporations and denying them the ability to spend their funds to influence elections. Given the recent Supreme Court decisions, it's hard to imagine decent campaign finance reform that wouldn't be struck down by the Supreme Court. So maybe what we need is so foundational as to require an amendment to the Constitution. It would also be helpful if people who are members of their local chambers of commerce took more of an interest in what the chamber's doing at their state level or at the national level. Because I think if they started to pay more attention, we might be able to rein in at least some of the excesses of the chamber at the national level.
Well, what are some of the ways that people can fight the good fight?
Well, I think before you even talk about the individual things that we can and should do, I think we need to step back and just look at our overall goals. Because I just don't think that the good works of 100,001 people out there working towards sustainability are going to get us to sustainability in a larger framework which is built on endless growth. I think we need to rethink that. I think we need to rethink how we measure progress. I think we need a new paradigm for organizing our society.
Philip Cafaro. He's a professor of philosophy at Colorado State University and a VP of International Society for Environmental Ethics. Phil, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Happy to be with you, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Sean Goho. He's a lecturer and staff attorney at Harvard Law School. His piece, The U.S. Chamber, A Record of Obstruction on Climate Action, appeared in the February 2010 on the Yale Environment 360 website. Sean, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
What got in your craw enough to take the time from your busy schedule at Harvard to write this piece on the U.S. Chamber for the Yale site?
There were really two things, I guess. The first was that it was, you know, 2009 when there was a lot of talk about the cap-and-trade climate change bill that was starting to work its way through Congress. And obviously in the context of that, it was clear there was a lot of opposition, and one of the main forces opposing it was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And it just struck me that they were taking a very short-sighted approach, really not looking at the interests of all of their members, because there are clearly going to be some long-term economic consequences from climate change that are going to hurt everyone. And I guess at the same time as part of that, you started to see some defections by some of their members, some companies that really did see that something has to be done about climate change and didn't feel the U.S. Chamber was speaking for them. Then the second thing was kind of coincidental. I just happened to be reading an environmental history of the 19th century and came across a discussion of the formation of the Adirondack Park. And what really struck me in reading that was the really major role that the New York Chamber of Commerce played at that time in fighting to get the park created. And to me, the contrast between what the New York Chamber of Commerce did back in the 1880s and what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is doing now was just so striking that I felt like it was worth commenting on, so people could see that a Chamber of Commerce doesn't have to be opposing environmental regulation. Maybe we take that for granted now, but I don't think that has to be the case, particularly on an issue like climate change, where it's not your conventional environmental issue. It's really something that is going to affect every single one of us, and it's going to have major economic consequences, not just health or environmental consequences. So it seems like, you know, it seemed to me that any business organization that's really taking the long view would have to see the importance of doing something about it.
What I really enjoyed about the piece was not just the contrast you drew, but this was not such a cut and dry issue. And it wasn't just they were tree huggers back then and now they're enemies of the environment. Can you fill our listeners in who are not familiar with the piece and with the Adirondack region?
The concerns at the time were really to do with the Hudson River and whether there were going to be a pattern of droughts and floods that was going to affect not only, you know, the damage caused by floods or the harm to farming from the droughts, but also the impact on commerce and shipping, which is obviously very important to the businesses in New York City. And what really triggered the crisis back in the 1880s was plans for extensive logging in what became the Adirondack Forest region. And as a result of this, the New York Chamber of Commerce actually created a committee that examined how they should respond to what was perceived everywhere at the time as a crisis. And they actually came forward with the proposal that the state should purchase millions of acres of land in northern New York to create a forest preserve. And it was, you know, it just to me seemed like a very forward-thinking and broad-minded point of view that the Chamber of Commerce was taking. But it wasn't just that they were doing it out of the good of their hearts. It was that they saw the importance of having regular river flows for shipping at the time and for power generation. And they, you know, they were doing something that was for the good of the whole community, but they also saw that it was for the good of their members. And this was in the face of substantial opposition from a segment of their members who actually stood to benefit from it. So timber and railroad companies stood to profit a lot.
They were the Exxon and Mobils of the era.
Exactly. I mean, what seems to be happening now is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on Climate Change is really taking the position of, you know, the oil and gas companies or the coal companies, who are the companies that would be the most likely to suffer short-term financial losses if there were a carbon tax or a cap and trade program put into place, or not even losses, but reductions in profits. Even if many other members of the chamber, particularly those involved in clean energy development, might well profit from that kind of scheme. So it really struck me that there was the same situation going on there. A narrow segment of the New York Chamber stood to make large profits, potentially at the expense of other members of the chamber and of the public at large. And back then in the 1880s, the New York Chamber took the position that better reflected the long-term profitability of its members, better protected the public and the environment in the long term. But what you see happening with the U.S. Chamber now on climate change is just the opposite.
And it's never easy to get any organization to take a long view, especially when there's incentives for management and other actors to benefit from a short-term view. How do you think the U.S. Chamber has evolved or devolved in this case to make it so that they're unable or unwilling to take a long-arching view of what their members are potentially doing to the environment?
Well, I don't speak as an expert on the internal workings of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but my understanding from what I've read and what I've heard is that, you know, they are an organization that purports to represent millions of members, at least indirectly through regional affiliates, but they have a very powerful core of staff in Washington, D.C., and that their policies are largely staff-driven rather than membership-driven. And they are one of, if not the biggest lobbying forces on Capitol Hill. You know, their lobbying budget as of a few years ago was $65 million, which made them by far the largest lobbying force on Capitol Hill.
And also, we should mention several prominent member companies also left the chamber, such as Apple and Nike.
That's right. So a number of companies either left the chamber altogether or else withdrew from committees in the chamber, you know, decreased their involvement with it. Those included Apple, Exelon, Johnson & Johnson, Nike, and Pacific Gas and Electric.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Sean Goho. He's a lecturer and staff attorney at Harvard Law School. I'm here on the U.S. Chamber site right now looking at some of their environmental issues and their positions. The first one that they mention says, "We support legislation that would minimize the impact on major emitters." That seems like such a benign sentence on one hand, in that they're minimizing the impact. But it's a great spin because it's completely anathema to any real environmental change, right? We're trying to help major emitters keep emitting is essentially what that sentence means, right?
Right. That's certainly my take on it, right? It's clear that they're position on any sort of climate change regulation at all is that, you know, they really want to avoid doing anything that will make serious change possible. You know, just last week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced the first results of its greenhouse gas reporting rule, where all the largest emitters of greenhouse gases had to publicly report what their emissions were for the first time. And what came out of that was that by far the largest proportion of emissions from stationary sources. So this is from things that stay in one place, not from mobile sources like cars. But but power generation accounted for a huge proportion of emissions. And what that shows you is that if you minimize the impact of regulation on the major emitters, then you're not really going to accomplish anything, because you have to go after the biggest sources if you actually want to make meaningful change in greenhouse gas emissions.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Sean Goho. He's a lecturer and staff attorney at Harvard Law School. Sean, let's go through some of these other points that the U.S. Chamber espouses on its website. They also say, we support legislation that would reduce price volatility for consumers and protect global competitiveness. What do you think that means, really?
Well, what they're getting at there is, I think, a couple of things. One, the big problem right now with getting anything done for climate change in the United States is the sense that we don't want to go first. China doesn't want to go first. Nobody wants to go first, and as a result, nobody gets anything done. So, there's this fear that if we take unilateral action, it's going to reduce our competitiveness if other countries are not taking action. But then at the same time, there's a lot of opposition to taking part in any multilateral treaty that would accomplish anything. And just to step back, that's more generally the approach the Chamber of Commerce is taking now. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, maybe when they weren't as disciplined on this issue as they are now, they used to make statements saying they question the science of climate change altogether. It seems like more recently their spokespeople have stopped making those sorts of statements. Now they claim that they're not disputing the science, but instead they just oppose any kind of action that will get anything done. So they're not saying that we don't think it's a problem and that we don't want to do anything. They just, if you go down the list of all the policy options that will actually accomplish anything, they oppose every single one of them.
And then the last piece, the last bullet point that had me kind of laughing out loud was make us the, quote, Saudi Arabia of clean coal by fostering carbon capture and sequestration technology. Now, this kind of leads me to my next question is, they have 3 million members or claim 3 million members, and I assume that the bulk of those are small businesses. How can small businesses benefit even short term from this kind of extreme anti-environmental stance?
Right. It's not at all clear how the majority of their small business members would benefit, or even if that sort of position represents their views or interests at all. It does show that on climate change, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's positions seem to be moving very closely in lockstep with those of coal companies and some of the larger oil and gas companies.
It sounds like the chamber is hostage to a handful of companies that would benefit from the status quo in the short term. I think we all will suffer in the long term for this, small businesses and anybody who enjoys to breathe clean air or drink clean water will be suffering from this short-sighted stance by a pretty powerful organization.
I'd say that's exactly right. You know, there was a comprehensive review that the British government asked for several years ago about the economic consequences of climate change, and the report that came out of it, the Stern report, concluded that the economic consequences of climate change would be like the Great Depression all over again. Now, of course, we've already, since that report was published, gone through something, you know, not as bad as the Great Depression, but certainly worse than anyone would have expected even 4 or 5 years ago, but still nothing to be taken lightly. You know, we're talking about potentially devastating economic consequences as well as environmental and health consequences. So it really should be in the interest of anyone who's concerned with economic growth to do something about climate change before it's too late.
Sean Goho, he's the staff attorney and lecturer at Harvard Law School. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by O'Donnell Levy, Gil Scott-Heron, Stevie Wonder, and Taj Mahal. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com.
That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.